The development of torpedoes is a rather interesting subject to look at, even if relatively little has been written about it. There are lots of dead ends and quite a number of mad inventions, along with other ideas that actually sound pretty good in principle, but turn out for various reasons not to work in practice. Now, while I've previously covered the development of the torpedo, looking mainly at the main line of torpedo technology from the earliest days through the Whitehead torpedo, and then obviously on into things like the Long Lance, the Mark 14, and other torpedoes of World War II, today we're going to head back to the 19th century, specifically up to the end of the 1880s, to take a look in a little more detail at some of the torpedoes and torpedoes technologies that ended up as dead ends for various reasons. So each torpedo will get a brief description, but there'll be quite a few of them. So first, we're going to look at the Warsop and Brettnell torpedo, and most torpedoes will be described this way, essentially named after their inventors. This dates back, rather surprisingly, to 1862, pretty early for a self-propelled torpedo, and very little is known about the weapon due to the lack of the inventors actually filing any patents or drawings. So all that we have left is a series of letters in the magazine The Engineer, as well as a report from HMS Excellent, the Royal Navy's gunnery school, which tested said weapon in 1862. Putting together these details, it seems that the torpedo consisted of an explosive charge and a compressed air engine, which was suspended from a float. To the float were attached wires, which allowed the whole contraption to be steered, with depth control set entirely by the length of cable that was suspended from said float. The propulsion itself claimed to be driven by air pressure stored at 600 psi, driving what was described rather unhelpfully as a feathering horizontal paddle wheel, although quite how that was supposed to work remains something of a mystery in and of itself. On a technical level, if they were actually powering this thing with 600 psi compressed air, that would actually be significantly in advance of what anyone else, including the Whitehead Company, was actually capable of in the 1860s. However, the Royal Navy tests found the device to be defective, according to them, and unable to reach its target, so they declined to experiment any further, which was pretty much the root cause of much of the later correspondence, as various people argued whether or not they should have done more tests, and of course the inventors disputed the Royal Navy's findings. In 1868, one Mr. Braham came up with a device that was in some ways a bit more like a spar torpedo, only without the spar. It consisted of an underwater tube that expelled a wood and iron explosive charge, which used compressed air to fire the thing outwards, but the charge lacked any form of propulsion on its own, so it would only travel a couple of dozen yards before it gently began to arc upward toward the surface, as it was slightly positively buoyant. Now, at best, it meant that you didn't have to travel around with a socking great long spar on the deck, and the attack wasn't exactly obvious, but there were a few major disadvantages. Firstly, an especially long spar could still outrange it, and if the attacker happened to be moving at any significant speed, then there was a good chance that once you fired it, you might catch up with your own weapon. Whereas at least if it was an explosive on the end of a stick, as with a physical spar, you were at least always at least that fixed distance away from the charge. Unsurprisingly, the Admiralty declined to test this particular invention, although the general concept would resurface later in the US, both in an underwater-launched form that was propelled by a ram that was itself driven by an explosive charge, and in the form of a diving shell, 10 foot or more long, and designed to be fired from a deck-mounted 15-inch Dahlgren gun. Britain, of course, was not the only place for these early attempts. Over in the US, as well as in the UK, several attempts were made to increase the speed and range of torpedoes using underwater rocket motors, something that will recur quite a lot in the following few decades. But most of the early rocket inventions seem to have lacked an appreciation of just how much denser water is than air, and while a few test models were experimented with, their initially high speed bled off rather quickly after the short burn time of the motor left it without further thrust, which made them far too short range for any practical use. In the early 1870s, word began to spread about the tests that were being conducted by one John Ericsson. Having invented the USS Monitor in the previous decade, he was now experimenting with what he termed a pneumatic torpedo. This resembled a very large, long metal suitcase with a couple of propellers mounted aft in front of a large rudder. Although it carried a 400-pound warhead, a payload that would embarrass a number of 20th century torpedoes, it ran on, or occasionally just below, the surface, but it was relatively swift for torpedoes of the time, albeit this meant a speed of about 9 to 10 knots, and it had a range of about half a mile. But to accomplish this, it had to be supplied with compressed air, which ran both the engine and the steering, hence the term pneumatic torpedo, from a source either ashore or on a launching ship via a long hose that trailed behind it. This, of course, meant that if you were launching it from a ship, said vessel had to hold position relative to the target while the torpedo gently meandered its way towards the target, and it turned out that as it went further afield, the drag of the hose through the water, especially if there was any kind of cross current, made the torpedo veer off course. By the mid-1870s, the self-propelled Whitehead torpedo had matched it for speed and range, while also being considerably easier to launch, thanks to being roughly cylindrical, somewhat lighter, and being self-contained when it came to the compressed air tanks. It could be launched and pretty much immediately forgotten about, as the launching ship could then go off and do its own thing. This meant that while the Ericsson device's warhead was a considerable advantage, being at least five times the charge of a Whitehead, if not greater, this advantage was largely negated by all the other problems just described. A more complex device was the sort of return of the rocket torpedo in the form of what can best be described as a sort of elongated unmanned jet ski with a rocket motor attached to the bow, which vented its exhaust under the float, which then sought to combine the force of the rocket exhaust acting on the water for greater propulsion with the lesser drag of the thing just travelling across the surface instead of underwater. Upon impact with the target, the warhead was released, as this was attached to the aft underside of the projectile for the journey, and was also connected to the bow via a chain. Once the impact occurred, a small charge would then send the warhead arcing down through the water, swinging up once it reached the end of the chain to impact the underside of the target ship. The complexity, visibility, and somewhat unguided nature of the weapon meant that it, perhaps fortunately, remained on the drawing board. Also technically of this period are the early versions of the Howell torpedo, or Howell torpedo, possibly. This self-guided weapon, driven by a large flywheel, would actually eventually enter service in the 1890s with the US Navy, but in a vastly modified form that included a pair of small screw propellers instead of just the one. But early versions experimented with all sorts of arrangement for the flywheel as far back as the early 1870s, using just one screw, among a number of other factors that would change, including its size. Its ability to self-guide was discovered almost by accident when the gyroscopic effect of the big flywheel was noticed, and the alignment was therefore changed to provide the relevant gyroscopic force in the direction of travel. Deviation from this by the torpedo could then be used to impart corrections to the guidance fins. It merits a mention here, as although the Howell was ultimately successfully deployed, its near two-decade initial development time, as we said, started back in the 1870s, and it was beset by many failures. Its eventual adoption into the US Navy was as much a testament to Howell's persistence as anything else. Another notable name in the 1870s was Victor Ernst Rudolf Wilhelm von Schelliha. Possibly. Anyway, he was a German engineer who'd gone over to the US in the 1860s to serve as a combat and naval engineer for the Confederacy, which is where most people who have heard of him have actually heard of him. But finding himself somewhat unwelcome in the United States in the aftermath of the American Civil War for some reason, he had decamped to Russia for a while. Here, he invented a torpedo that was similar to a Whitehead, but with a slightly more advanced engine and a guidance system that would be far more familiar to modern submariners: electrical wire guidance, which actuated electromagnetically driven guidance fins on the torpedo body. The relatively thin nature of the wires, compared to compressed air lines and the like, meant that there was little to no drag, and the device was ostensibly capable of travelling several thousand yards. This exceptional range for an 1870s period weapon was achieved by another invention of his, a small burner which heated the compressed air reservoir, allowing it to keep its pressure up even as the stock of air depleted, which would usually lead to a drop in temperature, at least until all the oxygen within the weapon and the compressed air was depleted, which would at least still leave some residual heat in the compressed air vessel for a while to come. This overall principle, which in various forms would go on to be used in almost all torpedoes of the 20th century, bar the electrically powered ones, would not see widespread adoption in most navies until the turn of the 19th century into the 20th. So why was his weapon not adopted wholesale much earlier than the heater torpedo was historically? Well, it appears that Shaliha's one big mistake was the method of delivery of the explosives. Rather than carry a big warhead up front, he instead attached a number of smaller, buoyant explosive charges along the top, with his idea being that the weapon, which at this point had grown to be something more of a miniature submarine, would then be driven around underneath multiple enemy ships and could attack them one by one by releasing these charges. But it was still unmanned, controlled from the shore or from a launching vessel, and the level of guidance and timing complexity needed to essentially blindly send explosives vertically through an enemy fleet was frankly beyond the capacity of the technology of the time, and despite forays into various improvements in the propulsion system, his odd reticence to simply just turn it into one big torpedo instead of a multi-charge mothership meant the eventual end of his efforts, coupled with the rather unfortunate choice of offering the design to the Imperial Russian Navy, which told him that, well, since he had no particularly great fortune to his name to pay for development and testing, if only he handed them the designs, they'd fund the construction and testing of the new weapon and then pay him once the weapon was in service. For those of you who are familiar with late-stage Imperial Russia and all its political and military systems, it'll be no real surprise that they simply then just took the designs, cut off pretty much all communication with him, then failed to understand the drawings themselves, and then failed to pay him for them because, well, if they couldn't understand them, they couldn't build them, and they weren't going to turn around and ask the guy they'd essentially just robbed for help. But all of that meant that he was left with negative money, and he ended up in a debtor's prison. Other Russian inventors built their own torpedoes, but they mostly also fell afoul of internal corruption, stealing their ideas or trying to pay them a pittance. Or also faced up to the fact that in this new field of underwater weaponry, Russia was very often 5 to 10 years behind the curve technologically compared to the rest of the world, which made it difficult for them to compete with the option of just importing Whitehead torpedoes. The fact that they even got close is actually a testament to the innovative nature of some of the Russian designers. But there were two notable attempts at unusual torpedoes developed in Russia, a liquid-fueled rocket torpedo that actually performed relatively well as a surface skimming unit in 1879, but when the tests advanced to the underwater stage, it turned out that the torpedo simply couldn't expel the pressure that was building up quickly enough in a submerged environment, leading to a rapid internal build-up of back pressure, which unsurprisingly caused it to explode almost immediately after the rocket was ignited underwater. The other attempt was a giant 6-ton, 39.5-inch weapon only ever exceeded in ambition by the Helmover torpedo of World War II, which was designed to be carried externally on a submarine, although at that size, given the size of submarines at the time, maybe the submarine was parasitically attached to the torpedo. But at 23 foot long, it was a little stubby for its overall dimensions and weight, and the compressed air engine was barely able to move the thing against significant currents, while also finding that it was being shoved off course by those same currents thanks to its relatively large surface area, and so this idea quickly faded out of view. Another inventor who had an occasionally tangential relationship with success was John Lay, back in the United States. He'd had some success in the American Civil War with spar torpedoes, collaborating with William Cushing, who'd led an attack with spar torpedoes that managed to sink the CSS Albemarle, or Albemarle maybe. In the 1870s, he came up with what was essentially an unmanned boat driven by a carbonic acid engine equipped with a 500-pound warhead. It was wire-guided with a range of 2 miles, and the large warhead being needed because, well, it wasn't actually submersible, as it actually ran just awash, in some ways resembling the CSS David from the American Civil War, and so it would explode against a ship's armour belt, so it needed a bit more oomph. When it was pointed out that this was a little bit of a problem, his first solution wasn't to make the thing diveable, it was to make the warhead detachable, so that in theory on impact it would sink somewhat before exploding. Although this did make the charge more lethal, it didn't actually solve the problem of the fact you could see the thing coming and shoot at it. It is notable, however, that he had attempted to solve another problem, one with the carbonic gas engine, which was used in quite a number of prototype torpedo designs at this point. The carbonic gas engine used water and carbonic acid to catalyse the release of carbon dioxide. And thus, if you paid attention in high school chemistry, you'll realise that this sucks in a lot of heat, and so the engine had problems with freezing up, because the reaction absorbed all the heat around it. By sending the carbon dioxide through numerous small pipes that were in contact with the water surrounding the weapon, as opposed to through one large pipe, he hoped to use the slightly higher temperature of even seawater compared to the generated CO2 to keep the temperature of said CO2 up beyond a point where it would start to freeze out the latent moisture in the system, which had some degree of success. But while the lack of diving capability could have been overcome with revised designs, the fact that you could also just buy 7 or 8 Whiteheads for the cost of a single massive lay torpedo rendered it quite impossible to justify in most navies on cost grounds. However, he persisted in iterating in his designs, a semi-submersible version of which was used in 1879 by the Peruvian ironclad Huascar, which had itself recently been the target of the first attempt to torpedo another vessel in combat, but this time the Huascar was attempting to sink the Chilean corvette Abtao, but something happened to the control wires after launch, and the torpedo instead doubled back at Huascar, and then refused to respond to any further commands. Luckily, the speed of the weapon was still quite slow, and so an enterprising lieutenant jumped overboard, swam out on an intercept course, and managed to kick the torpedo off course so that it missed its mothership. Just over a month later, though, Huascar was captured by the Chileans, and just over a year after that, a small Peruvian ship showed up with yet another lay torpedo, now trying to sink the errant ironclad. What is it with Huascar being targeted by early torpedoes? But, once again, the torpedo refused to respond to guidance and sailed off into the ether, although at least this time it didn't turn around and try and sink the launching vessel. However, tests in Europe of lay torpedoes proved to be somewhat more successful, albeit the large size, near-surface running and subsequent slow speed compared to contemporary Whiteheads made most prospective customers think of it as more of a shore-based defensive weapon for harbours and forts rather than a practical at-sea weapon, where the simpler, cheaper and faster Whitehead torpedo would remain the weapon of choice. Nonetheless, Lay continued experimenting, including a version which had the propellers recessed at the front end of the weapon instead of the back. And honestly, the sheer size of his torpedo in comparison to other torpedoes at the time maintained at least a passing interest for many. He also introduced a heater element so that the torpedo's speed gradually climbed from 9 knots to 12 knots, then 13, and finally to 15 knots. Also in the mid-1870s were various attempts to dramatically up the speed of torpedoes. Now, although a number of torpedoes using otherwise relatively conventional engines for the time did manage to hit 25, or in one case even 27 knots, this was usually over such comically short distances, measured in a few hundred yards or so, that the machinery was usually set for far more pedestrian speeds that would at least ensure that the torpedo made it to a target that wasn't already practically alongside and in boarding range. Rockets, though, would keep cropping up. A British clergyman experimenting with abandoning the idea of an underwater torpedo entirely and instead building a small planing hull with a rocket motor attached, which relied on being able to, at least theoretically, exceed 70 knots to get around the small problem of being very visible and probably being shot at with great enthusiasm. But this didn't seem to get past the small model testing stage for some reason. But that wasn't the maddest thing to escape the minds of British inventors in this time period, as one Lord Milton seems, as is common with accounts from this period, details are unclear, to have invented a small one-man submarine, again powered by compressed air, with a massive spotlight fitted in the bow along with the pilot's compartment, which would show the hapless pilot where to steer, the idea being it would highlight the keel of a ship that was underwater. The upper portion of the forward section of the hull was then taken up by a four-chamber remote-activated revolver cannon, with the apparent objective being to motor along up to the target hull and then shoot it repeatedly. Not to be outdone in the madcap department, a Mr. McLean in the United States came up with something that more closely resembles a Victorian period spaceship than anything else, the idea apparently being to create a framework upon which a pair of basic torpedoes were mounted, with additional tanks mounted above the main body of each to enable greater range, and possibly also for a degree of buoyancy control. Each weapon had a large, time-delayed spar warhead fitted to the front, and the whole thing, lacking any other form of depth-keeping, was suspended from a number of floats. Quite why a timer was used instead of a contact fuse was never made entirely clear, especially since one of the apparent objectives of this madcap thing was cost efficiency. But, not to be outdone, a Frenchman named Guillaume Gizet, I think, tried to build a rocket torpedo, there it is again, except this one had a rather fetching serrated harpoon on the front of it, to ensure it stuck into the target properly. And although, again, the explanation is somewhat unclear, he seems to have either invented a shaped charge, or else believed that mounting a warhead right behind the harpoon would drive it through the enemy ship, as part of the patent says, the spearhead may be made by means of igniting the explosive charge. Make of that what you will. Moving on to the 1880s, and the Paulsen torpedo is notable mainly for its early use of a pump jet, which was pre-charged before launch with superheated water, which would then be allowed to flash boil into steam, whose pressure would then be used to drive an enclosed impeller, which would take water in from ahead and then expel it behind at high speed. It had a little onboard heater to help keep up the temperature of the steam, as compared to the similar Hall torpedo, which was solely charged from its launching ship's boilers, and used a balance-activated pair of deployable wings to prevent the weapon from rolling. These folded in and out of the torpedo depending on its roll attitude, which made the whole thing resemble a kind of underwater F-14 or Tornado, as in the fighter jet, not the weather system. Another device was the Berdan torpedo, spelt B-E-R-D-A-N, which was proposed to the Ottomans by yet another ex-American Civil War inventor. This proposed a massive 30-foot-long weapon, or possibly longer, driven by the gases produced from burning gunpowder, or possibly a rocket using gunpowder. Again, details are somewhat unclear, but in any case, this ran on the surface under simple cable guidance, with a party piece being that if it encountered torpedo nets, which were just being developed at this point, it would explode, leaving a hole in the net, which would then be exploited by a second, smaller torpedo that it towed along behind itself, and which would therefore also be able to exploit any breach in a ship's hull if the main torpedo didn't encounter such torpedo net defences on its way in. Further attempts to refine the idea in light of improved torpedo nets only got somewhat more confusing in the descriptions. Not to be deterred, once that scheme fell through, Berdan went on to propose a 24-inch calibre submarine gun as an alternative, with about as much success. This decade also saw various proposals for torpedoes, both hopelessly old-school and interestingly new, but most of which also failed to go anywhere, both metaphorically and literally. This included an idea for a small float with a pair of rockets strapped to the back and a spar torpedo attached to the front, to be fired at the enemy in the manner of a jousting knight, although the inventor admitted that the twin rocket propulsion left its direction of travel on any given launch somewhat at the mercy of fate and cruel deities. On the other hand, there was also a proposal for an electrically driven torpedo which used capacitors, or accumulators as they were known at the time, to build up enough power to then discharge one at a time into an electric motor, with the control lines doubling as power cables connected to a shore station or a ship, which launched it, which could then be used to control both its direction and potentially also build up the charge in the capacitors or accumulators as it went on. The late 1880s saw the Neely torpedo proposed, This did away with the idea of a separate propeller and instead fixed a continuous screw blade to the torpedo body, then attached the engine directly to said torpedo body so that the entire outer shell of the torpedo rotated, with the screw blade then active as a large and somewhat long propeller. Another British clergyman, what it quite is with Church of England ministers and the obsession with underwater weaponry, I'm not entirely sure, but at this point he proposed a life-saving torpedo, wherein he replaced the warhead with a long line with floats, some food, some water, and various other bits of safety gear, and then controlled the whole thing via cables from the launch platform, which could either be ashore or another ship. He proposed then firing this torpedo at shipwrecked vessels that were otherwise too dangerous to approach with lifeboats and the like, presumably on the basis that a shipwrecked vessel can't get any more wrecked if you fire torpedoes at it, the idea obviously being that when the torpedo impacted and stuck in the hull at whatever passed for a waterline at that point, the survivors of the ship in question would then be able to head down to it, open it up, and retrieve the supplies. Presumably, the control cables would also allow the controlling ship or shore station to pull back the line that was built into the torpedo once it had been attached, and thus pull people to safety. Thorsten Nordenfelt also had an idea for a torpedo when he wasn't inventing multi-shot automatic cannon. In his case, this was a very finely calibrated 29-inch diameter weapon that was packed with batteries, which would provide the propulsive power. The calibration was supposed to be so fine that it was just positively buoyant, to the extent that the margin was so fine that a shark-like wooden fin could then be attached, and this would make the weapon slightly negatively buoyant, forcing the torpedo itself to go underwater. But of course, as the wooden fin was itself buoyant, at some point it would reach neutral buoyancy and the top part of the fin would stay afloat, providing a small marker for the guiding operator, as this was a wire-guided device. It appears that the cost of building such a large weapon, combined with the issues in keeping early batteries from spilling or otherwise failing when in long-term storage, plus the discovery that different areas of the ocean have different densities, which can actually affect such a very finely balanced weapon, which overall meant that, though promising in controlled tests, the battery-powered torpedo would in fact have to wait until World War II until being properly deployed in hangar. And that brings us up to the 1890s, at which point the technology of torpedoes was beginning to become widespread enough that most of the various flavours of madcap design outlined here, sadly in some cases, began to die away. And instead, new novel madcap ideas were invented for getting a torpedo closer to the target, such as large catapults, or gliders combined with catapults, as well as interesting ideas on the nature of the warhead. So if you'd like to hear about those ideas at some point in the future, let me know in the comments below.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.